Billing, who is Director of Planning for the City of Tampa during the Freeman administration. Thanks for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
During the time that the Freeman administration was in office, part of the responsibility of the planning department that was mandated, I believe, by the state of Florida was comprehensive planning.
Yes.
Can you tell me something about how that you were head of this effort to formulate the plan?
Yes.
Can you tell me something about how, what the process was, what the goals were, and so on?
Okay, well, it was legislation that was crafted by the Department of Community Affairs. And my involvement started with the legislation itself through our lobbyist, Kathy Bettencourt. And we spent a good deal of time in Tallahassee helping to shape that legislation. And in fact, a couple of provisions we were responsible for getting in there was something called two-tier service level analysis. And it was scheduled to be a plan that could be amended only once a year. That was expanded to twice a year, and it was based on our recommendation. And with that, we had some special legislation that in Hillsborough County designated the Hillsborough County City County Planning Commission with responsibility to prepare that plan. And the initial draft was in fact prepared by the Planning Commission. And when we received those, there was a problem with them in that elements like a recreation element, for example, was written to apply to all four local units of government. And the problem with that was we administered our programs differently. So we took, city planning staff took the elements of direct services that are provided directly to the public, such as utilities, water, sewer, recreation, those type of elements, and we rewrote them within a two-week period. And those were substituted and eventually adopted by city council. And then subsequently, every local government had to do a five-year update to that comprehensive plan. And when it came to those elements, the direct service elements, we took responsibility for drafting the updates and amendments, conducting the workshops, and then we would transmit those to the Hillsborough County Planning Commission. They would conduct a series of public workshops on them and then forward those elements to City Council for review and adoption.
Can you give an example of some of the elements?
Well, there was probably close to 20 elements. So water, sewer, drainage. We had some I'm failing to remember what all they are. And
did they have a direct impact, or did any of them have a direct impact in service delivery, would you say?
Yes, they had a major role. The way the legislation was written, the premise was that local governments could no longer issue development permits if they didn't have adequate services in place. So, or if you reached the level where your services had declined below the standard that you adopted in your plan, then you basically had to deny any new building permits until you could raise the level of service. Now, unfortunately, that it was a good standard for ensuring a minimum level of service in your community, but it was not a good standard for doing long-range planning. And we, the city, went back to the Department of Community Affairs and urged that they allow us to do a two-tier planning, and that is do our level of service standard to be used for issuing development or denying development permits, and then to adopt another standard that we could use for longer-range planning purposes. And DCA accepted that. And it was the legislation was amended to allow that. So basically, Tampa's approach became something that was and permitted statewide.
Now, when you say level of service, sir, is that the same as service level analysis?
No, we use the term service level analysis for something we were doing in-house. We actually, before the law had been passed, we were analyzing our services. And so it made it very easy for us to comply with the state legislation that came out. We were actually well-positioned, more than most communities in that regard.
And when you looked at service level analysis, was this to evaluate adequacy of services? Did it also focus on how services perhaps varied from neighborhood to neighborhood?
Well, the service level analysis, yes. In fact, both of them were that. So that was the purpose, was to get a good handle on what existing city conditions were for each service that local government provided. And that way it tied into the budget process. So when the decision makers decided where the next dollar was to be spent in each of these areas, they could do it armed with the information of what the disparity of services were at the neighborhood level citywide.
And did they often defer to your analysis?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. In fact, our role was expanded in that regard to be able to do this analysis in more and more areas of the city. So it actually was formalized under Mayor Martinez's administration. And during his first year, he came in and went through the budget process, and when it was over, he was not sure whether he had been finessed by city departments on what the real needs were. So he and the finance director asked me to come up with a process that in the subsequent years would allow them to have a good handle on what the actual conditions and needs were. So that's when we came up with service level analysis. Mayor Friedman continued that and expanded it into some other areas she was interested in.
This is now 2005, and there's much discussion about downtown development. Many condominiums have been announced.
Yeah.
And some people wonder whether there's any plan that's guiding this development. Did you get involved in downtown planning?
Well, Mayor Friedman got very involved in that, and then in turn involved my department in that, and several attempts had been made previously in other administrations to come up with the downtown plan, and one was by the now defunct Downtown Development Association. The Hillsborough County City Planning Commission prepared one. A couple of different consulting firms were retained, but none of them ever got adopted. Mayor Friedman appointed a Blue Ribbon Committee that was chaired by Park Wright at the time, who's now deceased.
Was he a Likes Brothers executive?
Yes, he was. And it was about a 12-member committee, and they were all stakeholders in downtown, involved either as landholders or major employers in the downtown district. And we were staffed to that committee, and we were charged to come up with and get adopted the first plan for the downtown district, and which ultimately was accomplished. And it was through her initiative and her persistence that it succeeded.
I know it was a long time back, but do you remember any of the kind of guiding principles of the plan?
Well, yes. There were quite a few. First, I would have to say we started by changing some land use codes. At that time, you could not build housing along the water's edge in downtown. None of that along the channel side was zoned so housing could be included. It was all industrially zoned. And it was industrially zoned on both sides of the river at the time. So we went about changing the zoning to make residential permissible use.
And if it's industrial zoned, you could have office buildings, is that true, but not residential?
Correct, you could not have residential, but you could have very intensive industrial uses in those areas, and a lot of the uses were warehousing. But it was an appropriate time to make that conversion, and it laid the groundwork for what is happening today, along with some other things that affect the amenities and the aesthetics of those districts.
Were there any height limitations included in that plan, or?
There were height limitations, and most of those height limitations actually were related to the FAA height standards set on downtown. So it affected the radar paths for the airports and the surrounding areas.
And as developers are announcing projects today, are they bound by some elements of this downtown plan? Is that still in effect, do you know?
Some of the provisions that were initially adopted were watered down in the subsequent administration under Mayor Greco's.
The belief was that they were too restrictive, was that?
Yes, they were more sympathetic to developers. Developers, for the most part, fought the adoption of the plan because it raised the minimum standards. It set higher standards for the quality of sidewalks, providing public art, providing public space, some landscaping, submitting new construction for design review, and design review had the standing to take into account architectural features of a building. So we were discouraging reflective glass at the ground level, flat box top roofs on the buildings, and a number of things like that. So the developers were not happy with it, though. Almost all of the Class A developers were putting those features in their projects anyway. But they fought making it a minimum standard or a mandate for development in downtown Tampa. And Mayor Friedman was a remarkable public official. She stood very tight and enforcing those standards, and many of the things you see today I attribute to her leadership and her backbone with enforcing that downtown plan.
When the Friedman administration first came in, you had already had a lot of cuts in urban programs accompanying the Reagan administration. Then President Clinton in 1992 proposed and Congress passed a program which did allocate funding to certain cities who applied for money to help engage in urban development. Did Tampa apply for those funds? One name that went by was empowerment funds, I believe.
Yes. In fact, Tampa might have been, for a city of its size, the most successful in the nation in securing federal grants and other grants, state grants. We were very successful, and probably the most successful under the Friedman administration. And at that time, the federal government had been cutting back its programs. It had cut back. You no longer had model cities, the CDBG, Community Development Block Grant Program, was being reduced dramatically, and there were fewer grants, but President Clinton still developed some targeted grants to help inner city neighborhoods, and the Federal Enterprise Zone was one of them. I don't remember the exact number, it was something like 8 cities were awarded those grants, so it was enormously competitive, and Tampa was one of the winners of a federal designation. And we also concomitantly won a designation for its state enterprise zone at the same time. So we were very fortunate.
I know that the plan you formulated was very thick, very
yes.
intensive in its analysis. Can you recall the process by which you formulated the plan? Because I recall there were several meetings and so on.
We were lucky in that we had already had scheduled before the grant was even announced and had been conducting annually a neighborhood conference, and something the city had been doing under Friedman's administration. And we had already had this year scheduled when the grant competition came along, and so we started our process. And part of being selected for the federal grant was how well you developed your plan using the neighborhood themselves to come up with the direction for it, setting the goals, objectives, and the fundable projects. And so we kicked it off in that as part of that annual neighborhood fair held at the convention center, and got a great deal of participation. And following that, we had an organizational meeting where they set up their own offices, and we came up with a meeting place and a community center near Lake and 22nd Street. And that we helped that community designate the boundaries. We provided staff support to them and developed the plan, taking our direction from them. And we had had some federal employees in the audience, unknown to us at the time, that had validated just how effectively we involved the community in developing the plan that was ultimately submitted to the federal government, to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and that went a long ways to getting that designation.
So that was a very successful effort. Are there any challenges during the administration where you tried to accomplish certain goals and were unable to for one reason or another?
You know, I'm sure there were. There probably, in fact, were many. But I, to be honest with you, I can't recall any, because we usually, it seemed to me that when we set out to do something, we pretty much accomplished it. And there may have been some grants that we went after and didn't get, but I don't remember them. All of the big ones, it seemed like we succeeded in getting awards. And of course, there were many things we would like to have done in terms of service levels for neighborhoods, particularly the low-income neighborhoods, that just were never enough resources to get us to some sustainable level of improvement. But even in those cases, we had, I have to say, we had a lot of successes with the resources that we did have.
Periodically, the military goes through a process by which it considers downsizing certain bases or even closing certain bases. Did they go through that process during the Friedman administration? And did you get involved in the effort to try to keep McGill open and strong?
Yes. Well, actually, it was kind of a bifurcated process. We had one committee headed up by Al Austin, whose role it was to try and prevent the base closure itself. And then I worked with another committee, and my department provided the staffing to another committee that came up with, should the base be closed, reuse, alternative reuse plans for that site. It's a beautiful piece of property. It ever became available, there may be a silver lining in it, because I believe we could have matched the economic impact with future new uses of that property. So we worked with another Blue Ribbon committee, and they came up with three alternatives that we submitted to the federal government. And had the base been closed, then the federal government would have done an environmental impact assessment on each of those alternatives.
You've mentioned Blue Ribbon committees a couple of times. Is this something that the Friedman administration thought was a good part of a wise process to draw together people outside of government, at least to a significant extent, to study an issue?
Absolutely. I think she wanted to make sure that it was a plan that was always offered to the elected officials for adoption, that passed the acid test of community involvement. And often she made sure that it had the stakeholders involved. So going back to the downtown plan for just a minute, It was amazing that you had major property owners, General Telephone, as it was at that time, Lax Brothers, numerous other property owners, Dick Beard, a major Class A office project developer. These kinds of people were on the committee, and this was a committee that ended up recommending major reductions in their property rights for the good of the overall development of the downtown district. And it was amazing that these people were not on the other side of the fence fighting it. And possibly, had she not appointed this Blue Ribbon Committee, they would have been very effective at killing this plan, just as the previous attempts had not succeeded. So I think it made it difficult, but I think it was the secret to her success.
Not far from downtown is Channelside area that has, again, recently developers announced projects there, and some have already been completed. Mm-hmm. Did planning for Channelside also commence during the Friedman administration?
Yes, that was another initiative that she had, which was to come up with a plan for Channelside. The aquarium had taken off, but there was not a real concept that could guide funding decisions on the part of the city in terms of what its participation might be in that district, and there was no concept for guiding our land regulatory kinds of responsibilities. So we came up again working with a very active group of property owners and tenants in that area, and came up with a general plan for the Channelside district. It started with one simple thing of just renaming the 7th Street to Channelside, as it's known today. But again, it was also an area that was not zoned for residential. That was changed. And the plan itself was had the power of showing that government saw a future in this district and was going to be very supportive, and made it easier for investors to come in and be the pioneers in the redevelopment of this district.
The Port Authority owned some of that land. And
they, too, became a very important player. And they started looking at the property, not for just maritime use, but for other complementary, non-port-related uses of the property.
So they were cooperative in terms of working on this Channelside area?
Yes. And the Channelside shopping district itself could not have been done without the port looking differently at some of that property.
Did you ever have to work directly or respond directly to city council people? How did the chain of command work, so to speak, or channel of communications?
Well, I worked directly with city council on issues involving city planning, but always with, I worked in terms of coordinating with the mayor and the chief of staff and my supervisor, who was the director of finance.
Who was that?
That was Lou Russo. And so I worked closely with, the executive decision makers anytime prior to any visit with city council. So I always felt like I was at city council knowing what the administration's position was on an issue and not just freelancing it. So, and it worked well that way. I never had any problem. I was never sent over to do anything that I found disagreeable or did not agree with. So I was very fortunate in terms of the administration that I had to work with.
Tampa has a strong mayor system.
Yes.
Do you agree with the notion that the mayor has clearly more authority than any other individual and more than the city council, or is it more split or divided?
Well, I think in terms of the things that city council has the power to act on and approve, I would say it's split. They really have to work in a partnership, and the mayor can't get anything accomplished unless they're on the same page. But But as far as the administration of government, clearly, it's a strong mayor form of government, and which is great for people like myself. As a department head, you can get clear decisions and can move quickly, and your ability to provide input and get decisions is vastly improved when you're dealing with one person empowered to make a decision on the spot if they feel like it.
You mentioned before when we discussed the comprehensive plan, the Hillsborough County Planning Commission.
Yes.
That has responsibility for planning for the entire county, including
right.
the municipalities of Tampa, Temple Terrace, and Plant City. Is there any way you can discuss the kind of division of responsibilities between you as the head planner for the city mm-hmm. and this planning commission?
Well, I started to work for the city in 1972. And at that time, when I was hired to provide, myself and some other people were hired to create a planning component within the city department that administered federal programs. That included the Model Cities program at that time. And the federal government mandated that you have direct planning in support of the expenditure of those funds. Now, the city had contracted prior to my being hired, and had contracted with the planning commission, and they were not happy with the service. So they created...
So was this, I'm sorry, was this Mayor Greco's administration?
This was Mayor Greco's administration.
His first administration.
So this was created in a department called the Metropolitan Development Agency. And we got very active in working with city departments and assessing conditions in the low-income neighborhoods that we focused on. And coming up with projects that were recommended for funding with the Model Cities funds. And administering those projects as well. Now, the Planning Commission chose to, I think, be threatened by the fact that we were in existence. And as time went on, the mayor that followed Mayor Greco was Bill Poe. And we made presentations to him on needs analysis in the low-income neighborhoods before we recommended to him expenditures of the Model Cities money. Well, it turns out he was so impressed with that that he said he wanted us to provide those planning services on a citywide basis for all of the funds that he was responsible for. So he abolished planning in that agency and created the Department of City Planning and moved us into City Hall. And at that point, the tension with the Planning Commission grew because we had a new role that had not been defined by state legislation, and we really took a very active role in providing direct planning support to the mayor and with city departments, and we became, I think, a very valuable resource to city departments. And so that led probably to some friction with the Planning Commission over the years, but our roles were generally defined where the state legislation defined them with responsibilities. We respected that and in many cases tried to augment and help them with that and to make their product even more responsive to the needs of city government.
There's another organization that's area-wide called the MPO, Metropolitan Planning Organization,
yeah.
that focuses on transportation. Did you interact with them as well?
Not very often. I did on a project-by-project basis. If there was a major thoroughfare being improved and it was in a neighborhood or a district that we were already working with the neighborhood on in terms of other plans, then we helped them. Often assign time from our staff architect to help them with urban design issues on the aesthetics issues for their transportation improvements, and they generally welcome that assistance. But our transportation department pretty much worked directly with the MPO. And then we worked with both of those organizations when it came to preparing the transportation element in the comprehensive plan. So that probably was when we were the most involved with the MPO. But we generally took the product from the MPO planning process and integrated it into the comp plan to meet the state requirements, not of DOT, but of the Department of Community Affairs, which often were not compatible or identical to Florida DOT's requirement.
This might sound like an odd question, but during the Freeman administration, you and the budget department were in the same administrative unit, is that correct? Well, you reported to the head of the budget, is that correct?
I reported to the finance director, which included the budget officer, the chief accountant, and the business and occupational licensing department.
Now, was that new with the Freeman administration, or that was the structure prior to it as
that,
well?
That was the original structure. It was never changed while I was there. I liked it because it helped integrate planning and budgeting process, which I thought was critical. So it made, otherwise you're doing planning for the sake of planning if you can't tie into the resource allocation process. So the budget...
That planning and budgeting was in the same administrative unit.
Oh, absolutely. It could not have been a better organizational decision. So the planning director and the budget officer reported to the same person. So it was very easy for us to integrate planning into the budgeting process and to have plans implemented through resource allocation decisions. So, and vice versa. Budget was in a better position to rationalize its recommendations for resource allocations because they had a stronger basis. It was grounded in needs assessment, something tangible, not a squeaky wheel approach to resource allocation, or just flat percentage changes across the board without much analysis.
So a lot of times when people think about a city planning department, they think exclusively of land use, but obviously what you did was much, much broader than that.
Oh, yes, yes, much broader. In fact, the day-to-day zoning decisions, administration of zoning was done by another department, so we were not tied up in that. But we were responsible, along with the Planning Commission, for the land use element in the comprehensive plan, which guided those zoning decisions. So we didn't need to be involved in the day-to-day administration. So we're able to operate with a very small staff and have a great impact.
Yeah, your staff, how many people?
It was never more than 10, which I thought was fairly significant for a city this size and the amount of responsibilities we have.
You felt you had ample resources, generally speaking?
I always felt like I could have used another person or two, but I had as good a staff as anyone could have asked for. So we were always able to, I think, accomplish what we were asked to do.
Many people are interested in urban design and urban aesthetics. You had an urban design person on your staff. Is that true?
That's true.
Was this a major focus of the Freeman administration, the importance of urban design, and maybe connected that, perhaps, public art?
Yes. We added a staff architect under Mayor Friedman's administration when we undertook the land use planning process. And I had the architect intimately involved in coming up with the design standards for the downtown district and working with the committees. And these were very intensive working sessions and numerous ones over a period of a year. And when it was finally adopted, typically that responsibility would have gone to the department that administers the zoning regulations and building permits and so on. But the committee recommended that the oversight for downtown be placed with this architect and with city planning. So we ended up having the lead role in design review of all new construction projects in the downtown district. So even the development community had a very favorable impression of our design specialist.
Did you get involved with public art as well? Is that a...
Yes, that was one of the provisions that was in that downtown plan. And I'd have to say it was sold at the beginning of the process. We took the committee to visit some other communities, and one of them happened to be Portland, Oregon, who has an outstanding outdoor public art collection and program. And so, riding back on the plane, it was the discussion was Tampa needed something like that. So it was an easy sell to this committee, and then we drafted provisions for them. They ultimately recommended the city council and got adopted. So public art used to be a requirement only for publicly funded projects, and it was expanded to include all private development downtown, and required that a certain amount of public art be spent on art that was placed outdoors or could be seen from the street side.
There's a lot of discussion about flooding in Tampa, South Tampa, for example, but obviously mm-hmm. the problem isn't confined there. Did you, as a planner, also have to deal with issues such as stormwater?
Not really. We worked with the department developing the stormwater element in the comprehensive plan. So it identified needs and set some development standards for permitting, and in fact set some long-range standards, but those long-range standards for that functional area just weren't achievable with known revenues that we were projecting for the next 20 years. So the areas that today suffer from flooding conditions are very difficult to solve. They're usually in the low-lying areas that don't drain well, gravity doesn't work well, and the bay backs up into during high tide storm conditions. So it's very difficult to solve, and some of the localized problems are enormously cost inefficient to solve. So we worked with the department, but only in terms of packaging an element, not helping them come up with solutions to those flooding conditions.
I know the mayor took different heads of departments to neighborhood meetings. Did you often attend these meetings?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way you can generalize about the type of grievances that citizens had?
Well, I think it ran the whole gamut, and quite often we would brief the mayor before we'd go to those neighborhoods on what we knew to be the condition of the neighborhood based on the data we had. And quite often the neighborhoods were validating that we did have a good handle on that a lot of the conditions were substandard in those neighborhoods and needed funding, take park and recreation. Through our program, she was armed with information where not only did she know which neighborhoods did and did not have parks, but the ones that did, what the conditions were. Were they substandard? Was the ball field below official minimum dimensions? Did it have restrooms? Did it have equipment rooms? Did it serve all age groups? And if it did, what was the condition of the swing set? Were they rusted out and collapsing? So she really had far more information than they knew about when she went into neighborhoods. She just did not have financial solutions all those problems.
Do you have any memory, and again, I know this was a long time ago, about what people in South Tampa would be saying as compared to those in East Tampa in terms of the major issues that came up?
No doubt they were different. And I have to be honest, I don't remember all of them now, but South Tampa issues were often with traffic, drainage, The inner city areas were much different, and the needs were quite often in terms of law enforcement, often drainage also, but you would hear the need for more recreation facilities. You would hear the need for more social services, and that you almost never heard in the South Tampa neighborhoods, with some exceptions, Port Tampa and some of those areas. But they were different, and that's to be expected. Your higher income neighborhoods were usually subdivisions that built into the project basic amenities that didn't exist in low income neighborhoods.
The Freeman administration devoted a lot of effort to affordable housing. Did your department get involved with that?
We got involved in terms of attracting grants that was administered by the Department of Housing. We were very much involved in that. So a lot of the community development block grant monies funded housing. And back in the Model City there, Eric, we were very involved in it, and then we were pulled out of that by Mayor Poe's administration, and then got increasingly more involved under Mayor Friedman. And that's where she used the service level analysis process enormously well. It was in housing. And in her first year, she set that department down and went over their production standards and how much money was spent per unit of housing provided. And she told that department head that she quantified what it would be in the second, third, and fourth years, and that was a condition of continued employment. And that department became enormously creative and turned it around, and they won several awards from HUD and Department of Community Affairs for their innovative approaches to housing. And she accomplished that by using the service level analysis, and she set measurable standards for them and a process to revisit them annually and before the budget process started.
Was this primarily the Mayor's Challenge Fund that you're referring to?
No, that was one of the innovations they came up with, was to leverage the block grant funds by challenging businesses to contribute. And so instead of making a one-for-one direct loan to an end user, they used the money as a bad debt reserve to guarantee loans made by the banks, who would take a chance in going into neighborhoods that, if you will, they may have redlined informally and weren't making many loans. And with a guarantee of so much money in this bad debt reserve escrow, then they were willing to use their own money to go in and make home improvement loans and new construction loans in these lower income neighborhoods.
Did your department do an analysis of lending, or I think you used the term redlining, during the Freeman administration?
No, we did that under, I think it was under Mayor Greco's term. If not, it was under Mayor Poe's. And we did that and collected data from the banks, and it was a way to convey a message to them that the law that was on the books, and there would be people like us looking at the lending patterns and trying to put teeth into it, and it may have helped. I don't know for sure, but that's why we undertook the study.
You entered city government in 1972, and you stayed. When did you retire?
97.
I know you're not retired, you're still working in the private sector.
Yeah, 25 years in the city of Tampa.
So that's a wonderfully long time period. Is there any way that you can summarize the changes that you were able to perceive during this time period in terms of what you were responsible for, whether it be changes in processes or achievements? I know it's a tough question.
Well, Well, I would say during the early years, during Model Cities programs, and I have to say it's probably one of my most satisfying years, because we had a large amount of federal funds to be spent each year, and I liked how we went about it. We systematically looked at needs before we ever decided how those funds should be spent. So it was a good basis for addressing spending money where the need was the greatest. And I think we did an awful lot of good in a number of low-income neighborhoods. And there were some very creative people that worked during that time. And then when we were reorganized into city planning, I think probably just the process of planning itself being a function of city government. Before, it was just something that was done by an outside agency on a very peripheral type of basis. So city planning being under the finance director, we were integrated into the resource allocation process, and that was very significant during the Martinez administration when he initiated this service level analysis process. And then as we went on, when the state required comprehensive planning of all local governments statewide, I think that was very significant, and we were involved in that, and I think helped the city make the most of that process. And we were always approved and had very few objections, which were numerous back then. Most cities submitting their comprehensive plans, and we breezed right through. So we felt like we knew what we were doing and had the support of the administration to do it right. So I'd say the strength there was the process. And then in terms of things that I personally take a lot of pride in, I'd have to say the downtown plan was one of them. It was the right thing. It was needed. We changed from being accommodating to doing whatever an outside developer coming in from out of the state wanted to do in this community, and set a standard and ask them to fit in with it and contribute. And Mayor Friedman's theme was ask what you can do for the community before you ask for help from us. And it did not endear her with the development community and others that they influenced, but a great example was a Canadian bank coming in that selected a piece of property on the downtown riverfront, wanted to put in a bank that looked like the Washington Monument, and a very sterile project. And we were, at that time, the community was desperate for new development downtown, and they didn't want to put in any river walk, any amenities, no landscaping, no public art, no design review. She held fast, and that's the site today that's hosting the Trump Tower that has all of those features plus. So I was happy to be involved in her effort in that. I think it made a difference.
Were you involved in the effort to get the hotel along with the convention center, or to serve the convention center business?
Yes, I was peripherally. Those were headed up by committees. I wasn't the lead staff to those committees, so we provided some support, but frankly, not an awful lot. When we got proposals in, we evaluated them, organized them, packaged them for the committee to review and make their decisions, and we didn't make any strong recommendations on any of those. Kind of had a life of its own, though we were involved.
Can you fill us in what you've done since you left the city? You're still a young man.
Well, I left at my son's urging and went to work for him and his business. He has a small little niche where he does background screening, and it's a business he started that he's very successful at, and he wanted me to help him with marketing. and he had some revenue goals he wanted to meet, and we met those, and he's now far exceeding them. And so I feel retired, though I work every day, but that's kind of my choice, and I enjoy working with him and watching him succeed.
Do you have any overriding impression of how the private sector differs from the public in terms of your experience?
Well, no, I don't. I think the way we went about our business, the work ethic in city government, which is different than what we're stereotypically perceived as, but those same work ethics apply in the private sector. And for me, there's not a lot of difference. When I managed the planning department, where we went about assignments was to give assignments to each staff member in writing that said what we expected and how many hours they were allotted to bring that project in. And supervision and communication throughout the process, and that's not any different than the private sector, or maybe we manage government business similar to the way a private firm would. So I have to say it's very similar as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you very, very much for speaking with me, sir.
Okay, thank you. My pleasure.